Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, if you visit the Smithsonian in Washington, you'll see the lunch counter from the Greensboro, North Carolina Woolsworth that African-American college students occupied back in 1960 in order to enforce their civil rights and be granted equal accommodation. What you won't see in Washington is the Katz drugstore counter in Oklahoma City. The young Oklahoma black children, some as young as 7 years old, occupied 2 years previously to force equal accommodation in our state. That nonviolent protest began in August of 1958 and would continue for 6 years, moving from restaurant to restaurant, peacefully asking for service until the final holdout gave in only after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Julia Clifford is an artist and filmmaker who tells this story, an important but largely unpublicized chapter in our civil rights history, in her documentary film Children of the Civil Rights. The film features the participants and the coalition of black and whites who worked to focus change and recounts the leadership of schoolteacher Clara Looper, who kept the sit-ins going for those 6 long years in the face of determined opposition. There'll be a screening of the documentary this evening at 7 o'clock at Helmer Hall on the University of Tulsa campus. That location has changed from Terrell Hall because of the crowd expected. That screening gets underway at 7 o'clock, and then there'll be a panel discussion with some of the participants afterwards. And Julia Clifford joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Julia Clifford, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of how this film began. Was this something you knew about growing up? What made you decide to do this film as an artist and multimedia artist and doing lots of different things, working for the National Park Service? What was the story behind creating this documentary?
Well, I grew up in Ardmore, Oklahoma, and never heard this story growing up. And about 8 years ago, I came back to visit my parents. I live in Bellingham, Washington. And I came back to visit my parents and asked my father one simple question. It was one of those moments where you really don't know what to talk about. And he was making coffee at the time. And I said, "What was your most significant moment in your life?" And he started talking about getting involved in sit-ins. Now, he's from Boston, so I thought, "Well, you mean Boston?" He goes, "No, Oklahoma City." I'm like, "I never heard about sit-ins in Oklahoma. What are you talking about?" He goes, "Yeah, it was started by these kids." And I'm like, "Kids?" So I went down to the library and started reading Clara Looper's book and spent the next 5 days at the library because you couldn't check it out. It's the only copy they have, and was hooked. Great story.
What was it about the story that caught your attention?
It was kids that started the sit-ins here in Oklahoma City. They started a year and a half before Greensboro, North Carolina sit-ins. The ones I learned in school were the first. They actually went for almost 6 years. I mean, 1 month shy of 6 years. And they turned around every restaurant except for one before the Civil Rights Act took place. I was so impressed. So at that point, I decided I have friends that know how to make film. We're going to make a film.
What was the story you wanted to tell? Like hearing it, you grew up in Oklahoma, never heard about the Oklahoma City lunch counter sit-ins.
Originally, I thought the film was going to be focused on Clara Looper. And I was not able to interview her. She was very ill at the time that we came to Oklahoma. This is an independent film, so I did not have any more income or any money to spend to come back, bring the film crew to film her when she was feeling better. It was actually a blessing in disguise because I found this archival film footage at the Oklahoma History Center where she starts talking about how the kids wanted to go down. And she said, "Are you sure?" And at that point, that's when the film became the focus on children, children of the civil rights.
Yeah, the film actually tells a much larger story than Oklahoma City. It really, it focuses on Oklahoma City, but it tells of the Greensboro sit-ins, the sit-ins in Nashville and Atlanta, the bus boycotts in Montgomery. It sort of outlines the whole situation where you have young people from James Meredith on who are saying they're standing up for their rights. In the case of Clara Looper, tell us a little bit about Clara Looper for those who don't know her. An incredible woman, wonderful school teacher, and it was actually an original play she made about the bus boycott that sort of stirred this feeling that things had to change in Oklahoma.
Clara Looper wrote a play called Brother President about Martin Luther King Jr., and she had just met him the year before, in 1956, during the NAACP National Conference. And so she wrote this play had her children perform it. She was just became the NAACP youth leader in 1957, and that was one of the first projects they did. The play was seen by the leader of the NAACP youth group in the nation, and he invited them to come to New York City. And once they went to New York City, and you know how kids are, they got to eat in restaurants. They wanted the same when they came back to Oklahoma. They wanted to have the same experience for everyone. And that's when they decided to go for this.
And of course, the film tells the story, a lot of the story of the sit-in through the participants now in late middle age. And that trip to New York can't be underestimated. It was like a night and day. They're not twin drinking fountains. There's not twin waiting areas. Restaurants seat them. Hotels house them. It was an incredibly eye-opening experience for them.
That's right. And Claire Luper was a very dynamic teacher as well as person, very dedicated to the American history, American life, democracy. And her strength was what carried through the whole process. She actually made sure that the children were safe. She continually talked with the police officer and told them what they were going to do, where they were going to do it. And they worked together as a team in a way, and very different than other parts of the country.
And after they came back, this NAACP Youth Council were meeting in a home in Oklahoma City, and finally came up with this idea of creating a sit-in. And Claire Luper was absolutely devoted to nonviolence. Eventually in August of, 1958? They decide to go to the Katz lunch counter, Katz Drug in Oklahoma City. Tell us what happened then.
They walked in, a group of kids, there were 13 of them. They walked in, sat down, and asked to be served. Of course, folks were like, what? and it was a surprise. There were a few people that yelled at them during that first day. But for the most part, it was a peaceful time. They actually just sat there for a couple hours during the lunch, like 11 to 1. And then at that point, they got up and left. And what was interesting, it's not in the film, one of the kids, the leader, she said to one of the other kids, go in and count the seats. And they went home, called their friends, and the next day they filled the seats, except for one seat. And so anytime anybody got up, the next kid would sit down in the next seat until the whole counter was full of the children the very next day. Katz took 4 days to turn around. It didn't take very long. They were a regional chain, so they decided across the region that they would desegregate their lunch counters.
And so rather than declaring victory and going home, the kids said, okay, what's next?
Yes, they went for the next restaurant. It took a week. And then they went to the next restaurant who said, come on in. And then they went to the fourth restaurant, which was John A. Brown's. And that was locally owned at that time. And
John A. Brown was actually a department store.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was a lunch counter there at the store.
Yeah, they had actually more of a formal restaurant, sit-down tables, waitresses that would come over to your table. And they, at that point, took 4+ years for them to turn that restaurant around. But they just kept going.
Now, as you mentioned, you said what you thought was a disaster at first, not being able to speak with Claire Luper. Of course, she died in 2011 or 2012. You found this great interview with her where she tells her story, and it's really amazing hearing her tell this story of how she did work with the authorities. She wanted to avoid violence. I mean, she was a teacher first, so it's protect your kids, yet managed to work out these alliances with probably some people who were inwardly sympathetic but not outwardly, and worked out all these relationships. She's an amazing woman.
Yes. The kids would go to churches and talk to the folks in the church. That's how my father got involved. He got involved fall of 1960. So they'd been doing it for 2 years. And my father is Bill Clifford. He was part of a Catholic church. He was wanted to meet young women because he was new to Oklahoma City, a single man, and 22 years at the time. So he joined a group called Young Christian Workers. And that group were teaching techniques for getting involved in society and helping to make change. And so being from Boston, he was from an area that had a lot of African-Americans there and was not used to the idea that they could not come in and eat in the restaurant. So that's where he decided to start. And that's why that his group joined in with the sit-ins.
You interview Father Bob Brousseau, who was sort of the leader of this group, and the Catholic Church took a strong stand. You had several Catholic ministers that would be arrested. And what really becomes apparent in the film, as you tell other stories of the children of the civil rights who are doing these same things around the South, is it was one thing when it was African-American children occupying the seats of a lunch counter, but when white kids joined in, all of a sudden this threat of violence all of a sudden escalated.
Yes, and different parts of the country, that's for sure that happened. You see that with the Freedom Rides. The person that got beat up the most on the Freedom Ride was a white gentleman who was first off the bus in Montgomery. But in Oklahoma City, what happened over the course of the almost 6 years, that it's almost like Oklahoma saw some of the things that were going in the deeper South. So they got a little more aggressive on keeping the kids out of the restaurant. They never got violent, but they would bar the doors. They would have bodyguards at the doors and only let white customers in, things like that. So then their tactics for doing the sit-ins or doing demonstrations.
Or picketing, yeah.
Or picketing. Mm-hmm. They did all kinds of things. They lie-in, sit-ins, squat-ins, where they would squat next to the door. And it was when they became a little more aggressive on Clara Looper's end, where they would sit in front of the doorway, where people had to climb over to get into the restaurant. Those were the times that they would get arrested. And they knew that. They knew they'd get arrested and get publicity for doing that.
Was it surprising to you that, you know, after the first few successes, that all of a sudden you would think that most of the restaurants would also change course? But it didn't happen that way. I mean, there was like these few holdouts, and they held out for years.
It is, in a way. The ones that were regional or national chains, I understand, they'd turn pretty quickly. It was established. I mean, your parents, your grandparents had this attitude or this belief. The Jim Crow laws the very first law passed in Oklahoma was 1907, and they grew through the early 30s when Clara Looper was a young girl. They grew to about 35 Jim Crow laws on the books, and Jim Crow law is segregating.
Yeah.
So it was a couple generations of people that this is the way things were done, that you had to change, and that's why it took a little longer for the locally owned stores to step up and say yes.
Now, after you weren't able to speak with Clara Looper, even though you have this great interview filmed that is a big part of the film, give us a sense of how you decided to tell the story. You tell the story through the actual participants reminiscing, and you had some really great interviews in there. One was with the now Congressman John Lewis, who was the first head of SNCC, and this amazing documentary footage of John Lewis as a very young man, really describing sort of his first actions in the civil rights movement. I don't know if that was after he was already the leader of SNCC or not, but amazing footage of a young man, and of course an interview that you got to do with him in preparation for this film. What was that experience like?
Oh gosh, John Lewis is the nicest man. I wrote him a letter asking if he'd be interested in an interview, and he was immediately got back and said yes, and we arranged it in Washington, D.C., I also connect with Julian Bond. We were able to interview him as well during that time period. And it was just one of those things that was so magical. He's a wonderful man.
Talk about speaking with the participants now in preparation for the film. Are they still very connected in the community?
The kids are in the film. They're actually 50 years later. Most of them are in this area. Barbara Posey Jones lives in Atlanta. She was the spokesperson for the young group when they very first started. I was able to get a hold of her, and she flew to Washington, D.C. when we interviewed Congressman Lewis. But the other ones are still in Oklahoma City. Many of them are very engaged, Joyce Henderson being probably the most prominent. She was a principal in a school that, when she was growing up, would not have allowed her to come to the school. It was segregated. And she's very active in the community, very graceful person. She's wonderful.
And what are their remembrances of this? Once school started, it became a Saturday and Sunday activity, right?
Correct. When school started, they started going down on Saturdays. They remember Ayanna Najuma. She's one of the youngest. She's a seven-year-old girl. If you ever see a photo where one of the first sit-ins, there's a little girl, 7 years old, in a white dress, and it's a classic photo of that time period. She talks about one time a gentleman brought down a monkey and released the monkey, scared the kids quite a bit. She has some stories where Joyce Henderson, the lady that I referred to a minute ago, Joyce Henderson, she talks about being crushed kind of behind a door because she was by the door. The guy opened the door, and she got kind of pushed back in the back. And she knew the gentleman knew she was there and was pressing up against it. And she so much wanted to pinch him. But she remembered what Clara Luper said about no retaliation. And so she just held her breath, and then the guy released the door.
It's funny. Clara Luper tells a story in that interview of Melvin Porter, one of the great attorneys who was instructing them on nonviolence. And, of course, the first time he goes down to the sit-in, somebody says a very bad word to Mrs. Luper, and he totally loses his cool. He said, and she said this great thing. It's a big difference from talking about nonviolence to participating in nonviolence.
Yes.
I'm paraphrasing it, but it was...
Yeah, believing in nonviolence rather than acting on nonviolent. There's a lady we interviewed for the film. She is in our resource disc that we give to teachers. She talks about how her mother would not let her go down. And it was because she knew, the mother knew, that this, her daughter, there's no way she would let somebody spit on her or yell at her without retaliating. And that was not what was needed during that time period. Yeah. They needed people, the kids that went down there to not be violent.
And Clara Luper also understood that. And so she devised other jobs for the people who couldn't maintain that sort of level of resolve and being subjected to, you know, unspeakable hatred and smile back, basically. And so she would find other jobs for those folks.
Yeah, you could either make phone calls, you could help bring kids down, you could help make food. I didn't even think about those kids are not fed. So
yeah,
they're sitting
eating.
There for hours.
Not being served.
So they had to have people make sure they were fed, you know, and all kinds of jobs that didn't mean you have to be out in the front line.
Yeah. And this went on for 6 years. I mean, most restaurants desegregated fairly quickly, but there were a few holdouts. And so these kids, a whole generation of kids participated in these sit-ins. And as the movement grows, we see that concerned white kids are also getting involved in this movement too. And you tell that story as well.
Yes. I thought it was important to show the whole picture. And that's why I also interview Congressman John Lewis and Julian Bond. I wanted some national leaders and also to catch them when they were young, what got them involved. Both Julian Bond and John Lewis first got involved in the sit-ins when they were 20 years old. Congressman Lewis first met Martin Luther King Jr. when he was 18, Rosa Parks when he was 17. And so they really helped bridge that gap, bring Oklahoma into the national story, because Oklahoma's story is not a part of the national story, and I wanted to change that.
It was at the time, though, wasn't it?
It was not covered very much at all. In fact, Julian Bond had never heard about it. When I talked with the journalist who covered the Greensboro Four, his name is Steve Delaney.
Yeah, NBC reporter.
NBC National and then international. But he covered the Greensboro Four. And he said he'd never heard this story up until I contacted him, you know, 50 years later. So it was just not something that was very widely covered.
So why do you think it wasn't? Because it was completely nonviolent? I mean, there were arrests, but there was never an outbreak of violence surrounding the actual sit-in itself. Now, Clara Luper, you know, she found shotgun shells left on her porch. I mean, she had her share of harassment. Was there any documented violence during the sit-ins?
Not really. I mean, they did get yelled at and spit on, maybe got shuffled off. One of the girls got pushed off her stool, but never any real outbreak here. And I think that was the major reason why it never really made national news. Also in North Carolina, there was not very much retaliation. The governor there was very adamant that they were going to follow federal law there. But you go to other states, Tennessee, you know, happened at Nashville, Tennessee. Sit-ins happened 2 weeks after Greensboro. And then the Atlanta happened 2 weeks after that. And they've had more volatile situations, especially Nashville, Tennessee. So they had over 300 sit-ins throughout the Deep South in the 1960 year. And I think the students that were participating in those were older. Again, here we had young kids. and you're not going to be volatile with young kids.
Right. And I think the other thing is that you had college students in those communities. They were there every day, whereas in Oklahoma City, when school was in session, it was a Saturday thing.
That's correct.
And you also talked to journalists who were covering this at the time. Frosty Troy, a very familiar journalist in our area, and several from the Oklahoma City area. They had their own thoughts on why this hasn't gotten more national attention and what was different about Oklahoma in its struggles to desegregate.
That's correct. Frosty talks about how when they went to the Korea, they integrated the army, and that was his first time to be around African Americans and to eat with them and have to sleep in the same area, that kind of thing. That really opened his eyes up quite a bit. Ernie Schultz is one of the journalists that we talk with, and he talked about how the kids were dressed in their sunny best, very polite and gracious people. And he just, you know, was quite impressed by the kids, and then looked past from the kids to the parents and realized, as a parent himself, this is impressive. This is, you know, there's no way you'd reach out and try to change what they're doing.
No. It's interesting, though, that even though it began in 58, they were still protesting when the Civil Rights Bill was signed by President Johnson in 1964.
Yes, I think that was another reason why I wanted to make this film. They kept going year after year after year after year. When you think about 6 years for a child, you know, the younger one I talked about, 7-year-old Ayanna Najuma, she was 14 when they finally finished. She did it every single time. She and her sister were part of the whole process because her mother was the best friend with Clara Luper. So I just cannot imagine imagine for myself as a kid going it down and doing that, you know, week after week for 6 years of my life. But they changed the country.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Julian Bond had never heard of the Oklahoma City sit-ins, even though he was one of the organizers at the Atlanta sit-in about a month after Greensboro started. What was his reaction when he found out that not only that Oklahoma City had been doing it for what would have been 3 years previous?
He was impressed. You know, John Lewis knew about it, and he had read about it in some of the African-American publications, Ebony, and he was very well-read in Ebony and Jet and things like that, and it was covered in those publications, but as far as the mainstream media, the national, the white media, it was not really covered. And so Julian Bond really was impressed with how Oklahoma handled this whole sit-in movement.
Now, your journalists that you talked to said, you know, they cited one of the differences. One, you had governors that were basically trying to win election based on being a segregationist, and two, that the white media of the state was an agitator. As you went back and looked at the old files of the Oklahoman and say the Tulsa World and Tribune or the Oklahoma City Times, what was the coverage of this at the time? Was there much coverage?
There was coverage, enough that I really was able to create a whole timeline and match up the stories I heard with the kids, as well as some of the items I read in Clara Luper's book with dates and times, and get kind of a full perspective of the whole situation. The only time that really got cantankerous, I guess is the word, I don't know, were they
was antagonistic,
antagonistic a little, yeah, bit, was during the editorial writings. That's the editorial pages sometimes had a backlash. But that was when you read the articles in the paper itself, they pretty much stayed as neutral as they could, you know, for the time. That impressed me. Compare that with Mississippi. One of the journalists in the film talks about how Mississippi, they called it, they had their headline read, "It's squirrel hunting time here in Mississippi," when they went down to Ole Miss, when Meredith was trying to roll in Ole Miss, University of Mississippi. Hmm. So very different language.
So what do you attribute to the fact that there was no violence during this long sit-in and protracted struggle? It was a protracted struggle, and there were probably a number of ugly incidents along there, but there was no serious violence. What do you attribute that to?
A major part of that was the police. They made sure that if the African Americans were doing something illegal, they arrested those folks. If somebody started heckling them, they would ask them to leave. If they didn't leave, they would arrest those folks. There was a time that to the young kids, a white, 23-year-old white guy and an African-American was sitting there, and he punched the black 15-year-old, and both were arrested. So the police were instrumental, they far outdid their job. They made sure that everything stayed safe for everybody. And they were, the main person to do that was I.G. Purser, who was the chief at the time. He actually would take some of his men that were a little bit more prone towards agitating, or maybe not sympathetic, and relocated them and brought on folks that were a little bit more even keeled for the whole situation. Yeah. And then at that point, they made sure whatever they needed to do, they did, and they kept it safe for everybody.
And what were your remembrance of the participants that you interviewed? Were they scared about the whole situation, or were they just resolved to change things? I would think the idea that when the first few restaurants switched their policy pretty quick, that must have been very buoying to them.
Yes, that was. And kids being kids, they talk about they had no fear. They, you know, a 13, 14, 15-year-old, you don't have, they're not afraid of anything, is how one of them put it. But the kids were pretty, they felt safe. They, the parents were a little more hesitant, but the kids were the ones saying, let me go down there. You know, let's just, you know, please let me go down there. They really enjoyed it. They knew that they were making a difference, and they could see the results, like you said, immediately. Within the first couple of weeks, they had success. And there were some days where it was a lot longer. They would go down for hours and hours and still, but they kept at it.
So what's your hope with this film? I mean, one, it is a remarkable story that these are not college kids that were doing this. These were middle schoolers and high schoolers that were doing this. What's your hope with this film? Even smaller, yeah.
Yeah, elementary. They started for the 5-year-old, 7-year-old. Ayana was 7 at the time, so they were first graders. What I hoped for this film is to have 100,000 audiences see it across the country. Now, audiences can be 2 in a living room, or it can be 20 in a classroom, or it can be 500 in a theater or university. The reason why I want that is because I think this story of Oklahoma's history really shows how we can make a change and how important it is to have nonviolent be at the core. And it doesn't matter what age we are, young or old, we can all make a difference. And that's I think this story, this film, really models that.
Now, have you talked to any educators about putting this in a curriculum in Oklahoma to further tell the story?
Yes, we're working on that. We made sure that this film met the school criteria with 9th and 11th grade, 9th grade social studies, 11th grade history. We worked with, at the time, Kelly Curtwright was the director of social studies for the state of Oklahoma, and we passed everything by him, made sure that this met with Oklahoma's history as well as the national history, curriculum. So it meets on all fronts, both local and regional and national. It meets the school criteria. So our goal is to get it into the schools, universities, high schools. We've shown it in junior high. Kids love it. We've had standing ovations from people in New York, from high school kids. That's really kind of neat to see after a film, a group of high school kids jumping out of their seats.
Julia Clifford, thanks very much for joining us today.
I sure enjoyed it. Thank you.
Documentary filmmaker Julia Clifford speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is the producer and director of the documentary film Children of the Civil Rights. There'll be a film screening and panel this evening at 7 o'clock. The location has been changed from Terrell Hall to Helmrick Hall on the TU campus. The screening is free, and there'll be a panel discussion with some of the original participants following the screening. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.